The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Monday, the 14th of October, 2019. On the podcast today, I have Tony Sirichik, Chief Executive Officer of Salt Lake Potash. That's SO4 ticker. And Tony talks through the highlights of their bankable feasibility study, which was released on Friday. Also on the podcast, I have Derek Wise, and a lot of people said, you know, previously, I mentioned this to Derek when he was first appointed at Bidstack, said, get Derek on, a fabulous amount of experience there. But Derek is non-executive director of Bidstack, and he discusses his impressive experience as an entrepreneurial software technologist, and also why he joined Bidstack. Plus, as always, two lists for you. The top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked RNSs. By the way, if you receive an RNS via the app, free to download at your app store, and you like the contents of that RNS, then give it the thumbs up, and it could feature right here on the podcast, and of course the front page at voxmarkets.co.uk.
Vox Markets is an online community of investors that runs a free mobile and desktop platform that allows you to track news and updates about any UK-listed company, offering RNS push notifications, detailed charts, pricing data, and much more. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Tony Sirichik, Chief Executive Officer of Salt Lake Potash. SO4 is the ticker there. Tony, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me back, Justin.
Yeah, some very impressive. You released your bankable feasibility study last week. That's out there. You've done a presentation as well, and that's nice on the eye. It's always hard reading through figures, I think, but you get a nice presentation, and it's worth looking at. It really brings out the figures, and we'll dig into the figures in a bit. Before we do, as always, Tony, for people not familiar with you or never heard of the company, can you just summarize what you're all about, please?
Sure. So Salt Lake Potash is a portfolio of nine potassium-rich lakes in what we call the Goldfields in Western Australia, so just north of Kalgoorlie. Of the nine lakes, we're developing Lake Way, which is the first of our sulfate of potash projects. And from that, we will be producing a premium soluble grade sulfate of potash to go and be the premium fertilizer around the world.
Yeah, well, before we get into the figures, it's worth, you know, differentiating between the two different kind of products, or the products you've got there, that your product, SO4, SOP and MOP. Tell us, you know, what's the difference?
So, yeah, the predominant supplies of potassium, mineral K, come from muriate of potash or sulfate of potash. And muriate of potash, MOP, is a KCl, Cl being the chlorides. So it's a cheaper product, but obviously there's an element of soil degradation, and it affects crop productivity as well. So SOP obviously has no chlorides. It has sulfate and potassium. And as I summarise it, it's an absolute requirement for crops that need to look good and or taste good. They can't have any chlorides in them at all. So basically, they're a completely separate market. And I really use the example of a thermal coal, coking coal similarity. So very different products, very different markets, very different end users for the MOP and SOP.
Yeah, and because of that, I'm looking at some of the charts here, that SOP, the price has been more stable. There's also, for you, more margin there, isn't there, the premium price?
For sure. You know, so SOP is a 7 million tonne current market globally. MOP is a 70 million tonne market. So MOP behaves much more like a commodity and more volatility, and the SOP behaves very similar to a specialty product, a lot less volatility. It's more stable, and absolutely, we like it. It's a high margin.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, take us through some of the figures then, Tony, if you could, from the BFS.
Sure, cracking figures. Very, very solid results for a circa Aussie $480 million NPV. That's up from the scoping study by nearly $100 million. The IRR is at 28%, and both those figures have quoted a post-tax, and a cracking 3.5-year payback on this first Lakeway project. What's very important is the $111 million EBITDA and a $78 million free cash flow per year once we're in steady state. So very, very solid numbers. And we touched on margin before. You know, the current sale price for this SOP is sort of that $500 to $600 a ton. We modelled ours at $550 a ton, and our break even is at $307. So a huge, you know, headroom, I suppose, between that break even and what the current sales price is.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's like I said, that the, you know, average annual after-tax free cash flow is 78 million Aussie dollars there. And this is just the first of potentially a lot more projects, isn't it?
Well, absolutely. The vision is that we become a multi-lake SOP province in Western Australia. And with the nine lakes, they're basically nine mine sites. And once we're up and running on Lake Way, we can cookie cut that construction and commissioning and operations across other lakes as the market demands the product. So we're in a beautiful box seat to grow a very, very large global business.
Yeah, and what is market demand like? I mean, you know, can it be satisfied there? I mean, is there plenty of, you know, uptake for your product?
Well, currently there's 7 million tonne per annum use of SOP worldwide. The analysts all forecast a 3% CAGR, that compound annual growth rate, there. So if you look at that over the next 10 years, it roughly equates to about a 250,000 tonne per annum project every year for the next 5 to 10 years. So our project here is 245,000, and come this time next year, bang, the demand swallows that up. So, you know, just on the population, business as usual growth, yeah, very, very powerful. Something that's not quantified clearly is, you know, what MOP displacement will occur when SOP is actually available in different parts of the world. And also this very high cost secondary producing of SOP by a Mannheim process, which is A, very expensive, and B, very environmentally unfriendly. So there's a couple of other upside positives there in the demand space.
Yeah. Okay. And so what's next now, Tony?
So next for us is Stage 2 construction, that is imminent, and that's on lake trenches and ponds. To put it in more clarity, it's actually 60 kilometres of excavated trenches and just over 400 hectares of solar evaporation ponds to sit alongside Stage 1 that's already complete. Stage 1 is 125 hectares of evaporation ponds, and that's done. It has nearly a billion litres of hypersaline super-rich brine sitting in it, cooking under the sun right now. So we're going to crack on with Stage 2 civils, and then come February, March next year, we commence plant construction, all ready for a wet commissioning at the end of next year, 2020.
Yeah, absolutely. Marvellous stuff. Okay, as always then, Tony, if someone's listening right now, likes the sound of this, but are not yet following the story, give them those three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page and add you to their watch list, please.
Sure. I always reference the three T's here, Justin. So the first one being thematics. You know, it's a clean, green, renewable energy sourced fertilizer that's coming out of Western Australia to go and feed a growing world and a growing population. So it's got a really nice thematic to it. The second T is the technicals. We've touched on a lot of numbers here in this podcast now. And so not only is it economically strong, it's also a very high grade product that's coming out as well. So the technicals are very powerful. And the last T is the team. So we've amassed a team here that's like no other, is how I put it. You know, in terms of construction and operation experience, it's, you know, somewhere upwards of 500-600 years of combined experience in the team now. And I'm obviously biased, but I think there are some of the best in their professions in the world. So the thematics, the technicals, and the team.
Marvellous stuff. Tony, good to chat to you as always. And hopefully we'll be catching up in the not-too-distant future. Thanks very much.
Thanks again, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Derek Wise, Non-Executive Director of Bidstack. That's BIDS ticker. Derek, thanks for joining me.
Thanks very much, Justin.
And since you joined, actually, and I've got to say, when I looked through your CV, I did a sort of video update a while back when you first joined back in July, and I did find you one of the most annoying people in the world. It's like you are, you know, amazing in business and the boardroom, and I look back further, and if that's not bad enough, like I said, this guy was an ex-Marine. He can kill you with your hands. If he doesn't beat you in business, he can beat you in fighting. And I was phenomenal. And so I think we should go back. I mean, you are with Bidstack now, and you're also with sort of Oracle as well, doing lots of stuff. But let's go back, so if we can, Derek, and start off, where it started for you, where it started getting significant in the world of sort of computing and gaming and all that. What's the first sort of significant step you took into this arena?
Well, I kind of started out running an online hosting business, so servers for computer game hosting, mainly because I was a big Counter-Strike player. Like when Counter-Strike first came out, me and a couple of friends had an Invitation League team that we played on, and decided we wanted to host servers for ourselves and a few others, and it turned into a business. A decade later, I was running a company called GNI, which hosted, I think, 44 games from 30-some-odd studios at one point, and I'd say the majority of massively multiplayer online games were running through our network at one point. Really, really fun, exciting thing. But that's really when I first got into anything more than playing games, actually participating in their development or operations. More in the infrastructure side of it is where I started, really.
Yes, but that must have been amazing that you're into gaming and pretty much as a hobby, and you realize, hang on, there's a business opportunity here. And it starts to work out for you. Did you actively chase that down, or did you find, when did you realize it was an opportunity?
I classify myself as one of the luckiest human beings on earth. So I was playing video games with my friends. We really couldn't find anywhere that was great to host the servers for us. So I got my office to agree to sell me some internet for the company I was working with, and built our own just because we wanted something stable. And off the back of that, I was hosting everything from back then it was Snapfish before HP bought it. I had some of PayPal's original servers on our network. Some of the largest games in the world. I had EA and Namco, Bandai, a whole bunch of big studios that were putting their stuff on our infrastructure, because I'd say in 2002, 2003, internet hosting was kind of weak when it came to things like online video games that are great for websites. They really weren't great for people who wanted low latency, first-person shooter, competitive gameplay. And even today, I'd say it's better, but it's not perfect. But yeah, that's why I kind of stumbled into it, and we kind of followed the trail through of customers that were begging for better service. So it ended up being video games is kind of an entryway to building high-performance online systems.
Yeah. So I don't want to miss anything else. So you were in the U.S. Marines. How did you pivot from that? Because a lot of people, I assume, find it quite hard coming, out of the military and into, civvy streets, and then doing very well there. But you seem to have done it with ease. How did that happen? How did the transfer happen from, being a Marine to that?
I probably had the wrong job 3 or 4 times in the Marines. So I was trained as an Arabic linguist, originally doing linguistics and interpretation for the U.S. Marines. And then they kept sending me to camps where they didn't need me. So after the first Gulf War, I wasn't really required anymore to do the Arabic translation thing. So they sent me to cryptography schools. So I started doing a little cryptographic work. And then I went to a base where crypto wasn't really that important. So then I went into telecommunications and IT management. By the time I'd gotten out, I had a ton of skills, everything from software development, programming, to IT operations. And it was kind of a good catalyst for walking into where the world was in 2000.
Yeah. And so what was the first, apart from when you started the business, started rolling, what was the first big sort of role you had where you thought, this is gathering some pace here, I'm liking this, and you thought you could sort of make some serious inroads into gaming?
Well, it was probably, I'm trying to think about what the first game companies were, but I met with Victor Keysleeves, the CEO of Wargaming, really, really early on before that game was ever successful with World of Tanks. And when I saw their pickup, their ability to monetize and doing it on okay infrastructure, but taking that technology and really revision it was a big part of making that game go from something that was pretty good, that had a niche following, to something that was, tens of millions of dollars a year in revenue.
Yeah, and then you joined. In fact, explain what GNI is about. Then I mean, you're CTO there, and you did. I said you successfully negotiated some funding there. But take us through that. What happened there?
Yeah, so that was my first business. So after I left the Marines, I created my own business. I ran that for almost 10 years, and about 6 years into it, decided I wanted to expand the company faster, so took my first round of venture capital. So my first time dealing with investment, I think I founded the company when I was 25 years old, so had no clue what I was doing. But around this time in my 30s, I bumped into some VCs in the San Francisco Bay Area, built a decent reputation with them, took my first $15 million in funding there to grow the company, and then sold it in 2009. And that's when I made the transition from hardware to kind of software development. I then went and joined a company in Iceland called CCP Games. It happened to be my favorite video game in the world, and still is. I still play the thing today, EVE Online, and took my passion and said, hey, I want to be on the other side of this. I knew the CEO there. They helped create a role for me to come in and manage their technical operations. And then I got to go from the hardware and operations and IT side to really starting to experiment with product and software development, which is where my passion was, but I hadn't had that much opportunity to participate there in the past. So after I sold my company, I decided my sabbatical was going to be learn software development in video games.
I see. And where from there, you must have been, when you think about it, you were 25 and you were negotiating funding rounds for $10, $15 million. You must have thought, wow, this is amazing. This is working out here.
Yeah, it's definitely fun. A lot of sleepless nights. I'd say the days aren't 9 to 5 usually, but it is a good time going out and seeing something grow, especially if you're lucky enough to have started something and see it grow as well.
Okay. And what was next? And what was sort of next or significantly next for you that you thought was a significant step?
So then I joined Benevolent AI. It's a company looking for cures for various diseases through machine learning and artificial intelligence methods like Alzheimer's and ALS and a few cancer-related diseases as well. So I've got to spend a lot of time there learning pipelines and systems and automation around artificial intelligence, and then joined this crazy 10-year-old startup in Cambridge called Grapeshot. Really phenomenal company founded by a couple of really interesting people, including a Dr. Martin Porter, that wrote some of the original algorithms around natural language processing that just about everyone uses today, even if they don't know it. And got to join in with them to build this cool technology platform that goes underneath most of what happens on advertising in a programmatic way today. And although I came in, the company was probably worth around $20-25 million, sold it for in excess of $300 million in August of last year. So I was able to see like a company really boom and what it took to transform from doing well and having high growth to like really adding value for investors. And so lots of happy investor friends, especially in the Cambridge area, that were early participants in that fund.
Yeah, I think you've been a bit, humble there. And I mean, you're joining there. I mean, as I said, it was a 10-year startup pretty much. But within 12 months of you joining, revenues had gone up by 160% year on year. Team grew from 120 to 250. 6 months later, you're responsible for the product. Like I said, the pitch to Oracle. And of course, Oracle, one of the biggest companies in the world. And so now you work, like I said, at Oracle, doing something I don't even understand, but it's contextual intelligence. What is all that about? We're getting to BidStack now. This is very exciting. What's all this about?
Yeah, this is why BidStack really attracted me, because there's a lot of overlap between my previous experience, my personal passions around video games specifically, and what I do right now is I run technology for programmatic market spaces. So what happens is there's basically a stock exchange behind the scenes that no one ever sees that trades that little ad space slot that's on a web page that you see in exchange for someone wanting to purchase it. But making good smart decisions about what page to purchase your ad inventory on is really dependent on understanding what the page is about. So we do that. We call it contextual intelligence, or context of the page. So we're able to, within like sub 10 milliseconds, tell someone, hey, this page is probably about automotive 4x4 luxury cars, so you are okay to place your ad here, or this ad is this is a safe place to place your ad. We focus a lot around brand safety, making sure that the environments match the place where inventory is relevant. And I get to be one of those good marketing people and say, hey, I'm trying to make it so that the ads are relevant to interests for the people that are there, so make it more viable for both sides. So mixing this together and understanding the sensitivities around video games, like not breaking the fourth wall, understanding that you want to have an immersive, relaxing environment, and being able to contextually understand where is the right place to place ads, when to put them there, when they're not relevant, and how to show a value, is really, really interesting to me. And and seeing what happened with GrapeShot and how well they grew, and kind of digging into BidStack a little bit and seeing what the opportunities are there. I think it's right on that cusp of having that opportunity to break out and have a really great success for its investors, should they be able to convert a few things.
Yeah, so yeah, exactly. I mean, if you look through your experience, it is you've had, you know, at all different levels. You've had really immersive experience at every different level here, from gaming to advertising. And like I said, you've done really well in several different companies. And then BidStack comes along, which is like I say, a microcap startup in the UK. Mm-hmm. A lot of investors are very excited about it because, of course, the world of gaming is massive and still growing at quite a decent pace. But yet, native in-game, you know, programmatic hasn't been tapped into really. So what you must have seen this, because with your background, you probably judge it, look into it. When did you realize that there was decent potential with BidStack?
Well, it's really funny. Like, I found out about BidStack very accidentally. One of my very, very good friends that I'd worked with 15 years ago, mm-hmm. was starting there as basically their head of business development for video games. And he knows that I'm really into this space. And he said, hey, can you do a reverse interview for me? Can you go check these guys out? So luckily, James and Fran were willing to have a chat with me. Mm-hmm. So I had a conversation with them, just kind of digging in, because I knew of companies in the past that I'd actually personally worked with, a company called Massive Inc. that had kind of done something similar to this maybe a decade ago, maybe more than a decade ago now. I was like, okay, do they really get how this stuff works and what the gamer environment's like? So Fran and James were willing to do this weird reverse interview with me, where I basically interrogated them and asked them what, to find out if they knew enough to so I could go give my friend the recommendation, yeah, you should work here. And at the end of the conversation, absolutely in love with the guys. They know what's going on. They understand gamers, which I think is a really core component to this. And then they have the team, and they understand monetization strategies around advertising too. So it's I kind of fell in love with them, and they asked me if I'd be willing to participate on their originally, I think it was advisory board. And we agreed that I'd be completely happy joining their board of directors because I was that confident in the business.
Yeah, yeah, and it's very interesting, because like I say, first and foremost, you know, you're a gamer, you love gaming,
yeah.
And then you've come from it from a corporate side as well, so you know exactly what, you know, is destructive to the gamer's experience, and the fact that, you know, the chatting to James and Fran, they validate their sort of, they're taking it and where they're coming from, it's good, isn't it? Because I mean, you can't get a better feedback from someone like yourself who, you know, is experienced in the world of business and is also, you know, a keen gamer.
Yeah, I think there's quite a few people who are gamers and are in business, but I think there are very few people that are lucky enough to have had both as a professional role. So whenever I bumped into these guys, I was like, I just wanted to dig in to see if they really knew what they were talking about. And I was delighted to hear that it wasn't just about, let's see how much we can monetize inside of online video games or inside of a mobile app. But let's see if we can do it in an immersive way, without damaging, the relationship that the brands have with their customers and the publisher, the video game publisher, has with their customers as well. It's a really tricky line to play, and I think it takes someone that knows and respects the industry, the people who play the games, and are willing to protect that a bit. So I think the guys were fantastic at conveying that story to me, and it's kind of what got me bought into the company as well.
Yeah, well, do you know what? There's a lot of excitement around BidStack, and of course, many people who hold that excitement also hold shares in the company, so that's yeah. A line in some way, but there are some people that don't get it, and they just think, what, we're just chucking ads in video games, what's the big deal? But so, I mean, where does it go from here? I mean, knowing what you know about the industry, how do you see it in the future? I mean, what's the potential here?
Okay, so I'll give you an example of why I think it's so cool, and I want to be really, really clear, like, this isn't promising how much money it's going to make or anything crazy like that, but from what I can see from my side, working in programmatic advertising, work with companies like The Trade Desk, AppNexus, MediaMath, and Amazon, and companies like that that are selling ad space. What I see is they're able to monetize inventory for web pages, and mainly it's called display. And it's a huge market. I think the market cap on The Trade Desk is around $40 billion. It's ridiculous what the company's worth. The opportunity here is this a new media format that isn't being monetized at all through those exchanges. So you can still get monetization for mobile apps, kind of, but it's basically on the app category versus in-game that's really related to the customer, as well as console and PC games that are traditionally not monetized on an exchange. There's a huge opportunity to deliver that billions of impression inventory to an exchange in a programmatic way and make it possible for the video game companies to increase their monetization mechanisms without hurting customers, and a way for media agencies and creative companies to really have a relationship with gamers that's different than what they have today. So not just having to spam on a website and own a whole website, that could really make it part of the interaction after a win on a race or after a score in a football game. I think those are the really meaningful things that could happen, where we're talking about a new way to engage with hard to reach gamers that are often a really good group to talk to, especially when you have technology products to deliver and consumer goods as well.
Yeah, and I think people struggle seeing this. Like you said, James has talked about this new ad category, and I don't think people understand how, you know, what it can tap into. That's the thing. They can't see the potential there. But you think it's a very real potential there, yeah?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So it's just another set of inventory that can be sold and traded, and advertising can be placed on it that doesn't exist today. So it's green space as far as first to go out and really dominate that is going to have a lot of control over the space, I think.
Yeah, yeah. And James has come on the podcast several times, and he said, you know, we're doing a year's work, which should be, you know, taking 3 years normally it would take, and but we're working in a methodical way to get these processes, to get this ad category, you know, validated and working properly, so it can be monetized. And I suppose that process there, I mean, you obviously talk with James a lot. And are you happy with how the process is going there? Is it going in the right direction?
Yeah, I'm really lucky. They let me out of the boardroom and I can go hang out with the product and development teams. So I get to see where they're going with it. And again, I'd agree with James. It's methodical. Nothing is going to be instant. So anyone waiting for, hey, we've got a magic program that does everything, really doesn't understand the complexities of the space. But the process for making sure the fundamentals are there first, so they have something strong to build on, and they also don't oversell themselves to clients and say, hey, we want your money now for something we haven't built yet. They're being pretty good with their customers about and making sure that they understand about what the value is today and what's being delivered, and trying not to make too many bold promises that aren't true yet. So I like that about the team. Very pragmatic and intentional.
Yeah, okay. One final thing, as a sort of futurologist in sort of gaming, what's the next sort of exciting thing in gaming, Derek, that you're sort of looking forward to, or you think will happen?
So it may not be exciting to everyone in the world, but for me, I think it's really interesting. There's this huge gap in the market around measurement. So one of the things that really matters to advertisers is can we prove that someone saw this, that it was viewable, that it wasn't viewed by a robot, it was viewed by a human, things like that really, really matter to advertisers today. And there are some of the largest holding companies and brands in the world have a requirement for measurement tools before they'll do any advertising spend. One of the things I think that Bidstack has the ability to do that I'm really excited about is set the standard for the entire industry to follow along. If that happens, I think it'd be a huge boon, and it'll unlock even more spending for the games industry as a whole, and specifically through Bidstack.
Marvelous stuff. Derek, it's good to chat to you. Thanks for coming on, because we, like I said, from the start, when you were first sort of appointed there at Bidstack, a lot of people said, get Derek on. So it's nice to get you finally on the podcast, and hopefully we'll catch up again in the not
too distant. Well, as long as you don't make me sound so scary next time, that'll be cool.
No, you seem like a nice guy, but obviously you are an ex-US Marine, so you know, you get a certain level of training that I'm daunted by. But Derek, it's good to chat to you, and hopefully we'll chat again soon.
All right, thanks, Justin.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five, Open Orphan, ORPH. Can't be far off news now from those guys, surely. And Kyle's been doing the rounds, talking about the company, and a cracking team they have there, talking about good teams there in regards to Derek at Bidstack. At four, Argo Blockchain Mining, ARB, ticker there. At three, Polarian Imaging, POLX. At two, Forexpo, FXPO down 2.3% at the moment. And number one, most followed companies, Premier African Minerals, up 50% at 0.142 pence. Okay, top five most liked RNSs are as follows. At five, Thor Mining. That's receipt of additional vendor shares in Hawkstone. At four, Zenith Energy, drilling program and well perforation activities. At three, Emerson PLC, Q3 newsletter. At two, Asia Met Management Update Call. And number one, most liked RNS, is director shareholding at Extract Resources. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Much appreciated.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.